Hi, I'm going to be talking about satellite geodesy, so I think I need to explain a little bit about geodesy. As part of satellite geodesy, we do sort of, as a byproduct, estimate the clock times of the GPS satellite system. And I'm going to explain how we do that. So in my research, that's just something we have to do. And I was asked to come here and explain how we do that, because what I'm really interested in is earthquakes and plate tectonics. And this is just part of the problem that you have to solve. I'll talk about GPS clocks and relativity, modeling the GPS light time equation, and how we actually invert for all of the clock biases. And I'll show you a demonstration of how we estimate the clock biases. So, for those of you that don't know, geodesy is the science of looking at the Earth's shape and how it changes in time, looking at its gravity field, and looking at its changing orientation in space. So it's quite critical to astronomy, for example, to understand all of these things. Satellite geodesy is the using of timing of photons between the satellite and the ground. It can work in different ways. It could be that you're reflecting photons off a satellite, as in satellite laser ranging, or it could be that you're sending photons down and back up again with radar altimetry. It could be that you're sending photons between satellites, as in satellite gravity gradiometry. And perhaps you're most familiar with is the GNSS, the Global Navigation Satellite Systems, like GPS and GLONASS, et cetera, where the satellite sends photons down and microwave frequencies. So there's just some pictures here of GPS. We get several new satellites launched every year, typically. There are 32 of them in orbit right now. Some of them are as old as 20 years old. And those old satellites, there are still four of them left that have cesium clocks aboard. But all of the other ones have got rubidium clocks on board. Turns out rubidium is actually better, in the short term at least. So that's a good thing. This is what the GPS satellite constellation looks like. The aperture of the constellation is about 50,000 kilometers. And this kind of just shows a cartoon where if you've got ranges to four satellites, you can solve for your user position XYZ and also your the error in your clock in your receiver. This means that if you're a user, you don't need an atomic clock because you can just solve for the offset of that clock with respect to the whole system. So how does it work? Well, the GPS satellites put a timestamp on the carrier signal. So the carrier signal's at microwave frequency. It's like, just think of it as a sinusoid, and then these bits are put on top of it. The bits are actually 180 degrees phase shifts. The important thing is that that carrier signal is driven by the atomic clock phase. So if the clock speeds up, so does the phase of the carrier signal. So you're actually really looking at the clock when you're looking at the GPS signal. And as I said, they're either rubidium or cesium clocks. So when the signal arrives down at the ground, the receiver time stamps the arrival of the signal, and the difference in those times gives you a bias range to the satellite. It's biased because you yourself have a clock error, but you can solve for that. So you're familiar with the GPS for car navigation. It's good to a few meters. What I do is called geodetic GPS, and we can position typically down to about 2 millimeters anywhere on the Earth's surface. And we do, there's a difference in technique, obviously, going from meters to millimeters. And we actually don't use this classic method, which the military designed for GPS. Instead, we directly measure the phase of the carrier signal itself. And that's how we can get three orders of magnitude more precision. We can measure that carrier phase down at the millimeter level. The carrier signal's got a wavelength of about 0.2 meters, and you can measure that to within about 10 to the minus 3 or something like that, 10 to the minus 2. This is a cartoon, if you like to think graphically. So you've got your GPS satellite clock, which is driving a microwave signal, which is in which codes are put onto, and that gets sent down to the ground. The GPS receiver generates, knows what this code looks like and generates its own replica, and then simply does a correlation between these two time series to figure out what the time difference is between the receiver clock and the satellite clock. Multiply by C and you get your pseudo range. So that's good to about a meter. And instead we do the carrier phase measurement, which is good to a millimeter, where we strip the codes off and multiply the reference signal in the receiver with the signal coming down. And you get this beat pattern. If you filter out the beat pattern, you get a beat signal. And it turns out that that's a beat signal. The phase of that is simply the difference in the clock phase of the satellite from the clock phase in your receiver. And of course, phase is just frequency times clock time. So this looks just like the pseudo range equation if you multiply by the wavelength. So it's the same equation. The only difference is you have an integer number of wavelengths that you don't quite know when you first start tracking the signal. But it turns out that you can estimate these and resolve these with 100% confidence in most cases. So that's sort of the principle of how GPS works. I need to talk a little bit about relativity because it's a big effect, especially if we want to be using these clocks to look at unusual behavior that might be associated with dark matter, for example. So if you look at the space-time interval between ticks of a GPS clock, we can look at it in proper time as viewed by the satellite, d tau, or we can look at it in coordinate time. And for coordinate time, it's convenient to choose a receiver on the geoid, at least ideally, because all clocks on the Earth's geoid run at the same rate. We can use the weak field limit for the metric. And so here's the space-time interval. And if we use the fact that the speed is just d rho by dt here, we can solve for the rate of proper time with respect to coordinate time. And if we make some approximations, because the velocity is not close to the speed of light and the potential is quite weak, we end up with this equation. So this is the usual time dilation effect. And it turns out to be about 7 microseconds a day. So that's quite large if you think about a nanosecond being 0.3 meters. This is huge, right? It's microseconds. General relativity is this effect here, and that's even bigger, and this has an opposite sign. And the total is negative 38 microseconds per day. So GPS clocks run fast by about four times 10 to the minus 10, which is a large effect. When the GPS system was designed, there were what they did was they actually adjusted the clock frequency so that you wouldn't see this on average. There was a lot of skepticism actually when GPS was being built that this would actually be seen. So there was an option to switch this on or off in the hardware of the satellite. But that option was never exercised because, of course, it turned out to be correct. So the frequency was shifted down.
So it is a true story. I heard about it as well. So it's really true.
Yes, it's true. Yes. and the reason. So this is shifted down so that ideally, so that coordinate time is like the SI second of a clock on the geoid, which, of course, is an equipotential surface. In practice, of course, we don't really have a clock on the geoid, but we can just pick a hydrogen MESA GPS station as the reference clock, and it's close enough to the geoid, so that's okay. And then all other clock times are estimated at every epoch. By every epoch, I mean, well, it just depends on how often you decide to measure the GPS signal. And typically, this is done every 30 seconds or so. But you could go up to 10 times a second if you really wanted to. So that's an option. But you need a global network that's doing that all of the time. There is a global network that tracks as high as one hertz, so one per second. If you really need it, there's about 80 stations that do that. But more typically, it's 30 seconds. So the GPS clocks appear to run at the same mean rate as a clock on the geoid. However, the satellite's varying its speed and gravitational potential. And a standard model to correct for this is just assume that you have a spherical Earth and an elliptical orbit. And it turns out those variations are at the 30 nanosecond level, so still quite large, 10 meters. And we want to get down to a millimeter, so it's still quite large. There are smaller, it turns out the smaller effects are very small. So what we do is we don't model them just because of convention, actually, because they could be modeled. And we totally absorb them into this clock estimate at every epoch. So that just goes into the clock. So if you look at the results, you have to keep in mind that these small effects might be in there, and they'll typically be harmonics of the orbit period. So the orbit period's about 12 hours. So you see those harmonics in there, and you can't, if you look at those harmonics, you can't necessarily say it's relativity because there's also orbit error at those harmonics. So it's a bit tricky. This just shows an early plot of relativistic effect in the 1990s of a GPS satellite. And in this particular case, it's about 10 meters. It depends on the eccentricity of the orbit. The orbits are quite circular. So this varies a lot from one satellite to the next. But we estimate the satellite orbits very precisely, so we know how to make this correction. And it turns out that both the special and general relativistic effects can be combined into one formula. So it's just a simple dot product of position and velocity that we use to make that correction. Okay, so that's dealing with relativity. Now we have to deal with the actual delay of the signal as it comes from the satellite down to Earth. And this happens over about 24,000 kilometers, about 0.08 seconds. Ago, that signal came out of the satellite. So you have to keep that in mind. So when you're computing the range, it's not the instantaneous range between your receiver and the satellite, but where it was 0.08 seconds ago. And in that time, the satellite's moved 300 meters. So we have to model a satellite motion, and that has to be done in the inertial frame, because the speed of light is only a constant in the inertial frame. There are some, you might read some papers which are, I think, are a little confusing to talk about the Sagnac effect. I don't like to think of it that way. I think if you think of it as being modeled in the inertial frame, everything works. If you do everything in the Earth fixed frame as the Earth's rotating, you also have to account for this so-called Sagnac effect, which is really quite fictitious. Then there's another general relativistic correction, which is to do with space-time curvature. So the distance between the satellite and the Earth is actually a little bit longer, and it turns out to be about 2 centimeters. And that varies, of course, depending on where the satellite is. The atmospheric delay is highly variable, especially the ionosphere. It can vary up to 2 orders of magnitude depending on whether it's night or day, or whether the sun is active with sunspots or not. So that can be sort of meter to 10 meter level. And GPS comes with 2 different frequencies, so you can actually calibrate that out to first order and to a very good approximation. Then there's the troposphere. The neutral atmosphere is about 2 meters. And we use the fact that it's a thin layer, a relatively thin layer, but we can estimate, if we know what the troposphere is at zenith, we can map it down to other elevations. So since we've got data coming in at different directions, we can actually estimate the zenith bias. And we can also estimate a gradient in the troposphere. So that can be done down at the few millimeter level. Station motion, the stations on the ground are moving up and down about 0.3 meters twice during the day from solid earth tides, just the breathing of the earth. And we can calculate that down at the millimeter level using a planetary ephemeris model for all of the for the solar system. Then you have ocean loading, especially near the coastline, can push the coast up and down by a few centimeters in some places. So these are the most important effects. There are lots of other effects, but I'm just showing you the biggest ones. I don't even have Earth rotation up here, but we have to solve for the Earth's orientation in space too. So typically the strategy for dealing with this is we take the observed and we subtract the computed data using the best model that that we have. We fix one station clock as a reference, and we can pick stations that are specially designed for this purpose, that are driven by hydrogen maser, or possibly a bank of clocks, such as at the U.S. Naval Observatory. And then we solve for all the other clock biases. So we might have 100 stations. We have something like 30 satellites, and we're estimating that. We only have to estimate it typically every 300 seconds, that's every 5 minutes, if we want to solve for Earth orientation, satellite orbits, troposphere, and so on. We don't necessarily need to go to the very high rates to do that part of the problem. We have to estimate all of the satellite orbits. That's the initial position and velocity would define everything if the orbits were Keplerian. But there are non-gravitational forces from the photons hitting the satellite, also Earth's albedo. There's also the sending the GPS signal itself puts some photon pressure on the satellites. So there's all these small effects that have to be modeled. We have to estimate range biases between every station's satellite data arc because of that integer problem that I mentioned at the beginning. And it turns out we can resolve that exactly. So effectively, these parameters go away at the end. Biases in the tropospheric model are estimated. So it's a big problem, and there are several, I'd say up to maybe 10 groups around the world that do this routinely as part of the International GPS Service. It's actually now called the International GNSS Service. And they publish their results, their clock solutions, they do comparisons, and gradually improve the system. So one approach is to do it the way that they do it, which is do everything all at once with this 300 second data. Another approach is to take their orbits that are produced from this solution and then solve for your own clocks at any epoch you want, let's say up to a second, but most of the stations in the world are tracking at 30 seconds, but you can get higher rate clocks this way. And they'll be just as accurate as the original solution, but at a higher rate. So I'm going to show you just a demonstration that we looked at. If it's just a minute, I could tell you a little side story to this. I was teaching GPS geodesy at UNR, and invited Andre to come along and listen into the class. The students had a project to do of their choice with some real data and using NASA's Gypsy Oasis software. And so we decided together to do our own little project like the students. And this is what we did. We looked at the clocks to see how well we could do. So what we did was we fixed the satellite orbits to those published by JPL, also the Earth rotation parameters. And then we solve for the clock biases at every 30 seconds, and we solve for all the station positions and the tropospheres and so on. And we help fix the station, which is called AMC2. This one has a hydrogen maser. We there are other clocks, such as USNO, which has a bank of clocks to define UTC. But we wanted to keep it simple just by having one clock. We thought we could interpret it a little easier, the results. What's shown here are the maser sites around the world that we used, and red ones are rubidium. Green ones are cesium, which turn out to be too noisy, really, compared to the other stations. And then the black ones are quartz. And quartz is just terrible, of course. You can't interpret it at all, but it doesn't matter. We're estimating it, and it turns out your estimate of station position does not depend on whether you have a hydrogen maser or whether you have quartz. You can do just as well either way, because we're estimating the bias at every epoch. It really makes no difference. But what's interesting about this is that we can precisely we can evaluate how good we're doing in the clock estimates by looking at the hydrogen maser stations. Those should look smooth if everything's working. And this is what we get. These are the hydrogen, just on a sample day, the hydrogen maser clock biases, accounting for relativity and taking out a second order polynomial. Actually, you don't really need to do that. First order is probably good enough. It doesn't make much difference. And this is in units of nanoseconds. And so I think it's fair to say that we're tracking the phase of these clocks to something like a tenth or two-tenths of a nanosecond. It's about a tenth RMS scatter, anyway, for those stations. Some of them even better. So that's with a second-order polynomial removed. If you just look, zoom in on 30-minute time period, let's say we're looking for some unusual physics in this time window. I haven't removed any polynomial at all from these, and I've put the error bars on. And you can sort of get a feel for what the noise is by looking at this. And this now is in tenths of a nanosecond. So I think we're sensitive at that level, something like a tenth of a nanosecond. If you look at the satellite clocks, they're not hydrogen masers, they're rubidium. And but nevertheless, we're still tracking things at the nanosecond level, tracking these clocks. And it could be that is how good those clocks happen to be, together with all of the hardware. It's not just the clock. It's all the satellite hardware, too, that goes into transmitting the signal. And if you don't remove any polynomials, this is what you see. So we're getting down to tenths of a nanosecond again for the rubidium clocks on the satellites. The cesium ones look a lot noisier, I have to say. This is just I just processed another day, and I included all of the satellites that I used on that day. So this is going from the best to the worst, if you like. The ones with the most scatter. You can see a clear difference between some of the GPS satellites and others. So there seems to be different categories of satellite. And it could be that this was a different, and I don't know, it could be that these were a different kind of rubidium clock that were installed, or it could be, possibly, that we're not modeling these satellites as well as these satellites. But I think this does tell you that our ability to estimate the clock is constrained by how well we're doing for these best performing stations, which looks like at the 0.1, 0.2 nanosecond level. So I think we can say that we can demonstrate that we're looking at these clocks at this level, and we could, in principle, could go down to every second. So this does raise the possibility of using the GPS system as a giant detector for topological dark matter is an idea that's come about, where we could maybe look for topological anomalies sweeping through the system and look for some spatial correlation in the patterns of the clocks. We can't think of many things that could possibly do that. We'll create a coherent pattern as moving across the constellation. And the kind of time frame we're looking at, if you think of galactic scale velocities, it's something like 100 to 200 seconds something could happen sweeping across the system. And if those kind of events are happening, I think I think the demonstration shows we have a good chance of being able to pick it up if the signal's large enough. So, okay, thanks. Yes.
Can I have a sociology question? So, people who do their sometimes crazy searches in the labs at the university, they're completely independent, you know, when they have like the students, postdocs working on this. And here I, you know, we've got to use the data that I used for very, very practical needs, right? And is there going to be some resistance from the community of, you know, responsible the bureaucrats or whatever responsible for this network? I mean, if they're doubting the DGR in the first place, I mean, what are the chances that they're going to allow them to use their data for some others?
Well, the community that was doubting DGR, that's an old one, right? It's a long time ago. And they were in the minority anyway. The community that's doing the high precision work is a different group of people. It's basically NASA, MIT, Caltech, places like that. It's not the people who designed the system or even responsible for it. So the operational system itself is still only at the few meter level, right? So and they're not that interested in what we're doing. So it's they're totally separated communities. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I think it's a question to these guys. So if it is an axion, the main wall that accounts for, you know, dark, whatever, matter, yes, what kind of, in these units of nanoseconds, what kind of shift?
We need to estimate that, right? I mean, I don't have an exact answer. I'd say it would be smaller, but it's just a hunch, right?
Well, I mean, Nina just told me that axions, I mean, you have to assume specific coupling, right?
Yeah.
So the gradient.
No, always. I
always,
mean, this is when. Yeah.
Right. So that is the definition, right? So, and if you have, so about the gradient coupling, right, it is an effective magnetic field that you're looking for. So it's going to enter these clocks only through the second order Zeeman shift.
Right.
And
that's a slight problem, presumably very small.
Yes, probably it is presumably very small, but at the same time, I mean, there are 10 years of data available.
Yeah, but I
want to
understand,
right?
Is it 20 orders of magnitude not good enough, or how many orders? I mean, or maybe it's already...
Depends on the coupling, right? I suppose that if you have a coupling that couples mostly to the spin, then probably the magnetometers are going to be a better tool, right? But if something couples directly to frequency, like wave of changing coupling, right? That would be much better with this.
Okay, sorry, if the experiment is done now at this 0.2 nanosecond level, will it be cutting into the parameter space already?
It should be, right? I mean, but you have to go through the second order Zeeman and do some analysis.
He's now asking whether if we take the favorable for us coupling, right? It's not coupled, say, to the spin, but coupled directly to the frequency, something like
mass portal.
The wave, right? We will a few nanosecond sensitivity or fraction of nanosecond sensitivity limit the existing models. And I think Andrei showed a sensitivity picture where it's indeed
it's
a not excluded territory, right? So cutting into
is that possible to see that in the same units as this at some point?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
We can
look at
the plot in nanoseconds.
has an analysis like this been done in searching for singular events like solar eruptions or major earthquakes or so? Can it be detected in this kind of analysis?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We've been doing this for decades, yeah. One of the first earthquakes I looked at was in the early 90s anyway. Landers earthquake in California, where stations moved about 2 centimeters at quite a long distance from the earthquake. And we picked that up. But it's used routinely now for measuring earthquakes, even as they happen in real time, we can do this. And also solar events can be tracked by looking at the difference in the signal at the two frequencies as it affects the ionosphere, for example. So ionospheric storms can be tracked this way. In fact, that's done operationally too. Tsunami warning systems that depend on this, for example, where the problem with seismology sometimes is the earthquake's so large that it tops out the seismic signal, and so they don't really know how large the earthquake has been. But if you have GPS, it doesn't top out. Course, the bigger the motion, the better. So it's got the opposite problem, let's say.
It's on the scale of a meter or so, but if it's a few centimeters, then it must take some averaging.
We can measure instantaneously, say every second, we can measure where something is sort of at the few centimeter level. But with averaging over a day, it becomes down to sort of millimeter, 2 millimeters or so. Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know who this question is for exactly, but you know, in our magnetometer network system, the magnetometers, the various new physics have certain directional sensitivity. They're sensitive to new physics along, you know, some plane, but not so much along a particular axis. Yeah. And you know, certainly with like a constant variation or something like that, I would imagine that there's not a directional sensitivity. But I don't know in terms of the new physics we're considering. I mean, is that something that needs to be taken into account? Some clocks, based on their orientation of the system, would be more sensitive or less sensitive to certain effects.
So it's pretty homogeneous over the Earth's surface, and as to where the satellites are in space, where it's slightly weaker is near the Earth's poles, but it's not a big effect. We're talking maybe.
He's asking about
the orientation
of the clock within the satellite, whether this would be, you know, if there is an internal orientation of the device of some sort.
Right, yeah, that's what I was trying to.
Oh, okay. You would have to ask somebody else that. Because that depends on the theory, doesn't it?
I think it does depend both on, I mean, it depends on the theory and exactly how the clock is operating.
Right.
I
wouldn't know that.
So, I mean, the concern would be like if there was such a dependence that, you know, you wouldn't want to necessarily veto certain events because we see it in this set of clocks and we don't see it in those set of clocks because, you know, maybe if there's some details of the sensitivity that one needs to take into account.
Is there an internal orientation?
Do you know the quantization axis inside the satellite?
No.
Basically, <I know. laughs> well. Probably it is possible to find out, right? So,
if a signal does affect the whole system, you've got them at different orientations, right? So,
all right, well, then you are going to have some sort of a cosine,
yes, a cosine,
right?
That's so interesting, yeah.
So, I guess more a sociology question, if there was a weird signal like this that happened over the last 20 years, and I think. It will be brought to attention of people, or would someone just kind of dismiss it and forget about it?
If we saw a spatially correlated pattern moving through the GPS system, I think we would take it quite seriously. We would have to look at the orientation in inertial space and ask if one of the obvious things to look at is it somehow pointing towards the sun? You know, maybe this there was this idea that maybe the solar wind could do something, but if these events happen sufficiently frequently, and it doesn't seem to be always, let's say, towards the sun or something obvious like that, then I think it's going to be hard to explain.
But I guess people will think about it and not just dismiss it.
Well, you wouldn't be able to dismiss it too easily because because GPS geodesy has been tracking station positions to at sort of at the millimeter level every day for since about 20 years, 1994. So it would be difficult to dismiss the whole system because it's working so well.
So, but I should add actually that so we looked at GPS data and we found, for example, a 40 sigma event, right? So, I mean, there are these occasional events.
But this is one satellite, yeah.
So, right. He also did the cross correlation, but the cross correlation didn't work out. But at least in one satellite, there was a jump of 40 sigma, and I think Keough was as surprised as we were, yeah, so is my student, to see the 40 sigma event. So occasional rare events like this do happen, but then you have to figure it out. Is it due to this, new type of physics, and then you need to do cross correlation between different satellites, or is it just something?
And I'm wondering, what is your reference system? I mean, the continents are drifting, and if you say 20 years, it means half a meter or something like that.
Sure. So for our reference system, there are stations in stable plate interiors, tectonic plate interiors, that are moving at a constant velocity in an Earth-fixed frame. And so we solve for their position at some nominal epoch, let's say 2000, and we estimate the velocity in addition to that. So the frame is tied to some epoch for those stations. And also we use the center of mass of the Earth as the origin of the system. So we're sensitive to that as well. So it's really, and we got the scale, of course. So the only thing that's really arbitrary becomes the orientation. That really doesn't matter that much. I mean, we just align ourselves in a conventional way.
So we probably should stop here and thank the speaker again.